He's generally credited with creating the best television newscast in Canada. Some people in Toronto might want to argue with that, but I don't think they have a point. He also started, as did many television geniuses, in radio. 1959 was the year. The man is Cameron Bell.
Hi.
Hi. How did you get bitten by the broadcasting bug?
Well, that would go back into prior to 1945. For some reason that I have speculated on, but I've never really been able to confirm, there was never a time when, as a child, I didn't want to get into radio. When other kids would talk about being firemen and things, I would explain that I wanted to be in radio. I even went to the lengths of taking my Meccano set, with which my family thought I would become an engineer, and fashioned a microphone because the little thing with the holes in it looked like an old 77. I settled on the theory that as a very small child living in Vancouver during the war, the one thing that my father chose over me was the radio during the war news. And I have a dim recollection of being shushed, somehow figuring out that there was things in the world more important than my five-year-old self. I think that may be where it started, but it was there the whole time.
How did you get into your first station?
After 1 year at Victoria College, now UVic, I returned to my home in Courtenay. CHUB Nanaimo had developed a strategy that they thought would prevent new licenses in the Comox Valley and in the Cowichan Valley. And the plan was to open satellite operations in each of the two locations. And the one they opened in Courtenay had a guy who would presumably do some selling and pick up a little local news. And twice a day, at 11:05 in the morning and 4:05 in the afternoon, he would go on the air and introduce four or five records that were played out of Nanaimo. There were a couple of flaws in this plan, one of which was that CHUB was hardly hearable in the Comox Valley. The signal, I think, bounced from Royston to Campbell River or something. When I got back from college in the spring of 59, father, who ran the telegraph office, suggested that I go and talk to the guy. I think maybe there had been a prior conversation. I was hired. I don't think I was paid, but I was appointed. Let's call it I was appointed. Went to magistrate's court every day. Did a few stories on the local drunks getting in and out of assault cases and stuff like that, which I guess was my introduction to journalism. I did that for a couple of months, and then I got lucky on a July 1st broadcast, and Nanaimo liked it, and they had a vacancy, so they called me down there, and I was then full-time employed at CHUB in the summer of 59.
Well, you were out doing the reporting beat right from the beginning.
In the little Courtenay bureau I was, in Nanaimo I was not. They didn't have, I'm thinking, I don't believe they had anybody cut loose from the station. They did have Larry Thomas, who even then knew everybody in Nanaimo, plus where everything was buried, I'm pretty sure. No, I was playing records and operating mainly.
Playing back in those days?
I can't remember.
Kind of pre-rock and roll.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
So probably the standards.
Yeah, although they did toyed with format. I remember that because I remember one of the problems was they had this giant old board and these giant turntables that took anywhere from 5 to 10 seconds to get up to speed. And they wanted Jerry Landa, who was working the evening shift. I don't know if I don't think I played very many records, actually, maybe on the weekends. They wanted a chime every time the time check made sense, except they didn't have one. So they found an actual chime and a great long handle with a little ball on the end. It would make the NBC chime, bong, 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 or any other chime that you could do with the four notes, I think, that were on it. The problem was the format required that your hands be on the tables to keep everything
slip cueing.
Yeah, because you couldn't do it any other way. So Landa explained to me and then demonstrated how the way to do the time tone was say something like "Chub time is," and then grab this thing in his teeth, nod his head, make some kind of a tone, drop it out, and tell you the time. What I was doing there, I don't remember. I was there only 2 months. I was working with some great people, fun people, Reed McLeod, Lyle Feltham, Gary Gooday, Larry Thomas, Jerry, an all-night woman named Jamie Scott, a guy named Vic Fergie, who was a superb announcer. Not a great voice, but a great announcer. Most of the guys were salesmen, so they would do a couple hours on the air and then go out and flogged. The guy who had been doing the morning show had been relieved and kicked out of the building for too much malt, basically. But after a couple of months being a good salesman, Des Kearney was his name, great old Newfie, he persuaded them that he'd dried out. And they wanted him to believe him because he was a good salesman. So they took him back on. Everybody moved down on a shift, and I was let go after 2 months, which coincided with the opening of the Courtney station. Just wandered in on my knees and asked Billy Brown for a job, and I got it.
So what were you doing when you went to Courtney?
I was playing rock and roll from 4 to 5 in the afternoon. Standards from, against Red Robinson, by the way, who was doing it on OR, who had much better, well, he had everything that I didn't have, including talent. And then I played standards in the evening, didn't news, did it 6 days a week. Did that for a year, basically. We had some fun. We tried to break one another up. And this would happen and get worse and worse for 3 or 4 days. And then Billy Brown, who owned the station, and had come out of Vancouver where he was the morning man on OR, come in and read the riot act and threaten us with all manner of things. And then it was Dick Drew and Eddie Cliff and George Cowie and me. And we'd all settle down and behave for a few days. And then something else would happen.
It was fun back then.
Oh, it was terrific. It was great fun. And I commend you for doing these interviews because I hope that the people if there are any who are interested in the old guys' reminiscences, will discover that it was an entirely different business and it worked. I mean, there were other things. Radio was in a transition between losing all its big stars to television and trying to figure out if it could make money playing records. And it was still limited to AM, and it was, I guess it had a lot of advantages that it doesn't have now, but it didn't have any of the experience, and they had people just trying stuff. A friend of mine, Bob Taylor from Victoria, came to town at my invitation, and I had persuaded the station that we could run a thing, basically an all-night music thing. And I went on the air and said I'd stay on the air as long as I got phone calls. We got phone calls till about 4 o'clock in the morning when the telephone company called and said, we only have one operator on. These are all manual calls and you'll have to stop. And I'd had a lot of trouble getting this thing approved. And so I said, okay, and I went on the air and explained that we were going away and shut it down. The next morning, Billy, the manager and owner who had resisted the plan, comes in and somebody told him about it. And he says, well, why did you stop? I said, well, the phone company. He says, oh, the hell with them. So we made people take notice here and there. And that was pretty much what Courtney was. It was local radio. They had information. Anything that happened in the town, basically, Billy talked about on his morning program between his George Formby and Gracie Fields records. That's what it was like. It was if it seemed like a good idea, you didn't have to check it.
Yeah, you just did it.
You tried it.
And if it didn't work, drop it. Well, go on to the next.
Exactly, yeah.
How long did you stay in Courtney then?
1 year, from September of 59 to September of August of 60, when I reminded Billy that he had promised me a raise. I thought I was maybe, you know, this was the start of a career. And he said, okay, what am I paying you now? And I said, $200 a month. And he said, oh, okay, well, there'll be a raise for you in your next paycheck. All right. So
I can see this coming.
$5.
Well, back then, you know, that wasn't...
2.5%.
What, you could buy maybe a case of beer with...
Oh, yeah, you could have. Yeah, yeah, it was a case of beer, basically. Well, $5, I guess you would have got two. But that was it. So I decided that my parents were right and university was the appropriate choice. And so I hied myself off to UBC in the fall of 60.
And what was your course of study?
I was just taking arts. I was supposed to be taking arts. But I discovered UBC Radio... And the break I got was I was the only guy, or I think I was the only guy, who had any kind of professional background. I now had a year in a real radio station. It was in a place they'd never heard of, but that didn't really bother them. One day there was a bed-pushing prank. CFUN, which was now rocking and interested in finding anything that would appeal to their demographic they were after, called UBC Radio and asked if anybody could do anything for them on the bed-pushing stunt. I heard about this, I overheard, and leapt in and offered. Went out on the balcony of the Brock Hall, which is then the student center. Lost my cue cert. They had a cueing system, but I didn't have it. I was had a microphone about the size of this one, maybe even bigger, on a stand with a bass, on a cable that ran probably 100 feet to get to the input plug. It was just a piece of craft. Because I lost the queuing, I had to take charge of it, and I did, and told them I would start in 5, 4, etc., and then I would do a queue, and then I would continue and whatnot. And I guess gave them the impression that somebody knew what they were doing, you know, which was probably at a premium in those days, even that little bit of craft. So afterwards, we talked, and they said that I should drop in, and so I did, and began working weekend reading news at CFUN in the fall of 1960, I guess it would have been.
While you were attending university.
While I was supposed to be.
Supposedly attending.
Yes.
So what developed from the CFUN job? You went in there, and did they hire you as a jock?
I was hired as a weekend newsreader. Then I worked full-time. Then Brian Lord was the first of the two. Lord and McCormick got the offers to join the KPOI organization in San Bernardino and Fresno, I think it was. They offered me 10 to 2. I did that for a couple of months. They weren't particularly happy. I thought it had great promise, but I didn't really know what I was doing, and I was kind of looking for mentoring. And I don't think at that point anybody really knew what they wanted. You know, I mean, they had been doing it for a few months. They knew what they didn't want, and they could tell you that, but that led to, it was pretty boring, basically, if you just take stuff out, even if it's the boring stuff. I mean, somebody explained to me that format radio was just a way to avoid local guys talking about what was in their lunch pail, you know. Yeah, I did that, and then they moved me to the parent company at that time, was in Welland, Ontario. One guy's still in the business. I think he owns a bunch of stations. A guy named Redmond. Bob Redmond.
Yeah.
Okay, and then Gord Bennett was his sidekick or the partner, and the two of them bought CFUN. They had a station in Welland, and I was sent down there with basically the guy who hired me out of UBC had been moved down there as a general manager as the program director.
So this was your transition?
That was the news job, yeah. That was the one where I was doing news, although the guy who was running the station there, not the guy from CFUN, a guy named, forgot, probably better because of what I'm going to say about him, but he really didn't like the idea of somebody being parachuted in, and he was not pleasant to deal with at all. And he decided my voice was not good enough to be on in the morning, so I would work in the afternoons, which was fine, I didn't mind. Then he decided that I should do a commentary every day, 5 o'clock. Well, I'm 20 years old. What do I know? Even if I had any idea of what I was doing, you know, but at the age of 20. So basically, I developed a formula, which was to get the afternoon edition of the Toronto Telegram, which was sort of a right-of-center paper. Whatever their lead editorial was, I argued the other side for a minute. And that went along fine. And then I decided I should try some on my own. I did a few, and then a few days later, I was fired. And they didn't give me a reason. In fact, I still have a letter saying that I've got a lot of assets and bright young fellow, but I'll never be a radio person. Several years later, maybe 5 or 10 years later, I ran into a guy who recognized my name and said, "Oh, you used to work in Welland." I said, "Did you do editorials on the radio?" "Yeah, I did." "Did you take a run at the Catholic Church?" And I said, "Well, what I did was I said that there was a story that a jury in Belgium was considering whether a murder charge should be laid against a woman who euthanized her thalidomide troubled child. And as the trial began, Vatican Radio went on the air and explained what the jury had to convict. And I said, that had happened in this country, that would have been grounds for a mistrial. It took the station lawyer 4 days to figure that out and to confirm it, but he did. So anyhow, I said to this guy 5 years later, what's this about? And he said, you don't know what happened. I said, no. I said, I know I got fired a few weeks later. He said, yeah. He said, my mother-in-law was the head of the Catholic Women's League, and they called the station and said they should fire you. And they refused. They stood behind you. So they organized a committee that went up and down the main street of Welland, and they said, you want a boycott by the members of the Catholic Women's League, or do you want the radio station to get rid of this punk kid who's going after the church? And they really, I guess, didn't have a choice. Their only choice was whether to admit it or not. That was a few years before Pierre Burton got canned from Maclean's magazine for writing a column in which he explained why he was going to explain birth control to his children. Well, we're talking the early 60s here, and this might sound really weird to people today, but that's how it was.
Oh, after Welland?
Came back here. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I came back here. I made a couple of perfunctory attempts to find work down there, and if I'd stayed longer and worked harder at it, I probably could have. But I came back here. I stopped to visit a friend in Seattle at a fraternity house there. Next morning, my car had been stripped of everything I owned except my typewriter, and the Seattle police were very solicitous. They said, yeah, there's been a lot of that around.
Yeah, don't park here.
Yeah, exactly. So I came back to Vancouver and I got a job at CKLG as the operator for what I believe and always have maintained is truly the first talk show in Vancouver. The host was Don Wilson. It was called The Voice of Vancouver. It ran 9 to 11 weeknights, and it actually had the form that talk shows do today. Nobody or very few people were paying much attention to LG in those days. It had tried two or three different formats, some of which were ahead of their time. I think that was the first talk show in town and maybe in a lot of places. I was the operator and the call screener and that sort of thing. I did that from 9 till 11 at night, and then I played jazz till 2 in the morning, signed it off and went home, except on Saturday nights. Saturday nights I played jazz and standards from 6 at night till 2 in the morning with nothing on the log. Zero, nothing. That's when I met the Barnett twins, who later ran all sorts of restaurants in Vancouver, had just opened a pizza joint, and I phoned them. And when they delivered the pizza, they said, maybe we can make a deal here. So that's where I discovered Contra. And for the remainder of my year there, whatever it was, I I ad-libbed a couple of spots for the Barnett's Pizza Place, which was down on Davie. They made good pizza, too. Mm-hmm. I would phone them and say, here's what I'd like. Turn your radio on. And then I would tell other people what I liked about their pizza.
Did you get in trouble for this?
No.
Of course, none of the bosses were listening. They were all in bed, asleep.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or out carousing.
Carousing on
more likely
on the money they'd made on the week.
you spent a year at LG doing that.
Then they went to a format. They went rock. The PD was a guy named Don McTavish, who went on to run the BC Recreational Vehicles Association. But he told me I did not have what it took to be a rock and roll disc jockey. Well, there's a trend that's starting to emerge here.
You've never succeeded in this business until you've been fired a lot.
Yeah. Well, he told me that I wouldn't be on the payroll after the transition, which again coincided with the start of the UBC year.
You went back to UBC?
I went back to UBC. I was still trying to finish second year at that point, and I did that for a while. How I got from LG, and then I moved into a fraternity house to the border, and then I moved to the island. I think I worked a summer out of Campbell River for the Billy Brown organization. Then I came back, went back to school, and somehow got a part-time job at WX, but I don't remember exactly how.
That was when it was on Burrard Street in the palace.
It was, yeah. Oh, yeah.
The
gorgeous
broadcasting
place.
Palace.
Beautiful. Yeah, I worked there. I worked there quite a lot, actually. It was more than part-time for a while. I think I worked a summer there or something. This was when...
You're pretty much out of the jock business.
Yeah, I got a few shifts, weekend shifts, and I enjoyed those, and I know one or two listeners enjoyed them. That's all you ever get anyhow. Yeah, I was working very early in the morning, and I, with John Barton, who was doing the morning show, and Jim Robson, who's just a prince of a guy.
A ton of great people.
Oh, yeah, I was really in. Ron Robinson was doing the operating. He was operating. I can't remember the entire sequence, but I do remember that whatever winter that was, 65 or 66, we had a ton of snow here, bad snow. I think there was 6 or 8 feet over 5 or 6 weeks. We had a series of major snowstorms. WX had two news cruisers, News Cruiser 11 and News Cruiser 30. Jim McDonald, who was a sidekick on the talk show, I arranged that if I could get to the car, I would do traffic cut-ins in the morning. That's what it was. I was living at UBC, and I'd get up at 3 in the morning and find out if it was snowing. If it was, I'd take the buses down to the West End, lean on his buzzer till I woke him up, get upstairs, knock on his door. The door would open 3 inches, and a hand would come out and drop me a set of keys, and I would then have an equipped car to go around and drive around the snow and do traffic reports, and did. That opened up an area for me. Can I tell you about Jim Robson? I was working one day, I think it was a Saturday morning, and Jim was in there. Jim Robson, as I say, he's a really nice guy. So I'm sitting in the newsroom, and I'm on the air, and I'm reading, and intermittently there are these small balls of paper landing on me. But it's not a big problem. There's just a few, you know, and I can take them off and remove them, this sort of thing. So we get to the commercial 4 minutes into the news, or 4 and a half, and Jim comes over to me and he says, well, congratulations. I really tried to break you up, and you didn't. You held, and that was great, Cameron. I mean, you know, this is a big market, and you know, it's good that you have the professionalism and you can deal with it. And I said, yeah, okay, thanks very much, Jim, but I appreciate it, but I'm just getting ready. No, he said, I really, and he's... He's hovering over me and explaining how professional I've been and not breaking. As soon as the light goes on, he picks up the barrel, which is about 3 feet deep and 90% full, and dumps the whole mess on my head.
The pranks back then were just everybody tried to break up everybody else.
Yeah,
par for the course.
Yeah, yeah. That's
a lot of
true.
Fun.
Yeah.
So, the big dog. How did that happen?
Well, I don't know exactly how it happened. I'm working at 4 o'clock in the morning, okay? I'm doing what I can. WX has invested quite a lot of time and money in Mike Titherly and Rex Ellis, who later worked for ABC. And they're going to do featured newscasts. Titherly at noon, Ellis at 8 o'clock in the morning. I had all the rest, but I wasn't featured. So I made a deal with John Barton. Give me time at 7 o'clock and I will give it back to you at 7:30. He said he didn't even care. So I was putting together a pretty substantial newscast at 7 o'clock in the morning, monitoring NW like crazy. And actually, I found out later there were some ratings and we were starting to show there. I also had a little bit of a trick I used at 9 that got a few numbers. So I'm still a new guy in the market. You know, I'm part-time at school and this kind of stuff. Guys from school are trying to phone in phony tip. Every year, the biggest press party in the year was the pre-opening of the P&E. Jack Lee used to run these parties, and they were memorable. And at one of these, I had never met anybody from NW. I'm standing talking, I guess I'd met some, I'm talking to Dave Abbott, and I hear behind me Barker. I'd never seen the man. So I said, is that Warren? Yeah. So would you introduce me? He reaches over and he taps him on the shoulder, and Barker, with his cigarillo in one hand and his drink in the other, looks over the rims of his glasses at me and Dave. Dave says, do you know Cameron Bell? And Barker says, in that voice, you know, he says, oh yeah, Cameron and I have a little war of nerves every morning at 7 o'clock. Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty high praise.
If we're having a war of nerves, I'm in the game. So a few months after that, I was driving around the news car and I got a couple of stories, and which was significant because for every one I got, Garrett got about 100. And the ones he didn't get, Carl Ways got. So, you know, I was... Anyhow, they called me and they offered me a job, and I went to WX and I said, they've offered me this job, but I'd rather beat them than join them. And they said, oh, we're going to do big things. Well, 3 months went by and we were still waiting for the big things. So I got another call and I went out there, mainly to drive, but also I worked Barker's shift one night and I made it with a lot of help. And when I finished, I went to Hal Davis and said, never again. I don't know how Barker does that, but what Warren does, no human can accomplish. And I was there from like 3 in the morning or 2 in the morning, and I had everything I thought, but it just happens so fast. And that's another thing, you know, that I think people should understand, is that the NW newsroom in those days, which was about, it was about the size of...
Somebody told me it was very small, the physical size.
It was 4 or 5 phone booths, basically. And that included a big container that had three teletypes in it. You had, in any given hour, both guys on the desk had a newscast to write, a stack of assignments that you had to follow up on, phone people and get quotes, record them on old Magna Quarters and that sort of thing, and checks. Somebody would hand you, you'd have this thing that said, whatever, police checks, and there were, I don't know how many lists there were, but the phone company was trained. You'd phone them and you'd say, oh, this is NW, we want to make code letter 9 or 14 or whatever. Then the phone would start ringing and the operator would say, I have Merritt on the line, I have Prince George on the line, and with these all day, every day. Some of those sources are no longer accessible because the police have now discovered
that, everything.
Well, and they've discovered that if they control the flow of information...
But that's now backfiring on them with all this social media stuff.
I mean, that was the other thing, you had to handle tips. But the in those days, it was not at all unusual for everything that had been mentioned up until 10 o'clock in the morning, or 10:30, I guess it was, because they had half hourlies. That was all gone by noon.
The transition.
There was a whole bunch of new stuff coming. It was just, if you wanted to know what was going on at a certain level in the city, that was a place to be tuned. And then Webster would tell you what was going on at the political level. You were plugged in, and they were coining it. They were making so much money. They've claimed now that more recently has been more profitable.
Because there are fewer people.
Yeah, exactly. So I don't know
people
about
people are
that.
Your most expensive asset, especially the good ones. They cost a lot of money. Other people I've talked to in this series have said if CKNW couldn't beat it, they bought it, basically with talent. They would go and if somebody was very good on WX or somebody was very good on another station in the market,
I think that's true.
They would go out and offer them more money to come and work at CKNW.
More money or a better deal or a better shift.
In 1968, when you were at CKNW, you made the transition to television. How did that happen?
Two things happened. The vacancy that I originally filled was created when BCTV decided to go to country's first hour-long evening news in September of 68. My availability was based on two things. One was I casually had bumped into the news director, Andy Marquis, and told him I'd never been in a television station and I wouldn't mind doing that. But at the same time, I was working for NW. My shift was Friday night, Saturday night, those are 3 to 11, Sunday morning 7 to 3, Monday morning 7 to 3, and Tuesday all day at City Hall.
It's a little wearing.
And that was because George Garrett had the best shift, which was, none of them were great. Carl Ways had the next best shift, and then Terry Spence had the one after that, and I was the fourth guy in. And it's significant, right? There's four reporters on the road. Nobody else had anything close to that. But I thought that I should have a news car rather than drive mine around. I was on the phone. I was sitting in the press room of the police station on the phone talking to leasing companies to see if there was a way that I could lease a car. In between calls, Channel 8, then Channel 8 called me and said, "We want to take you to lunch." I think they'd heard a story I had done. There was a cow, a poor cow, got loose at the PNE and got out of the barn area and was in the big parking lot north of Empire, what's now Empire Field, and they were scared because it was going to go on to McGill or someplace. Anyhow, they must have had 40 police and firemen and everybody else out, and this poor cow, scared out of its mind, was eluding it. And I thought it was kind of funny. I shouldn't have, I suppose, but I wrote this piece about the posse and then the cow. Anyhow, somebody apparently heard that, said, "This guy sounds like he might have something to say." They took me for lunch. I was disposed because of the lack of the car, which Barker had nothing to do with. It was the front end of the station. So I took the job, which was as a reporter.
And what was your beat when you started out? Was it a general assignment?
Well, it depends on what time of day. When I went in on the morning of the first day, at 9 o'clock in the morning, I was a reporter who worked for Andy Marquis and would go out and do general assignment stuff. 2 hours later, I was called a features reporter, and I was working for the producer named Al Clapp. And Al had made a deal with the station, which was he would produce the newscast, which was dicey because there were no resources. None. They were getting them, and I was among the first, along with Don Timbrell and Chuck Davis, but they didn't have the resources. Clapp said, "I'll produce your newscast, but I want 15 minutes of it every night to do whatever I want. Whatever you want. Well, what are you going to do?" "I don't know. Whatever I want. But I need a reporter and a cameraman. I'm the reporter. Bill Lynn is the cameraman. That next year or less, for me it was only 3 months, that was an introduction into what television can do, not what it was doing. Clapper had some ideas. He'd come in the morning and there were bizarre notions, but we did everything from in-studio interviews, just normal ones, to we had a cabinet minister who was always blustering. Al says, I think I should moderate, and the actual interview should be done by a woman who was part of the problem. The minister, Ghilardi, couldn't do his bombastic number in front of this woman. It was just bad form. And she just annihilated him. I interviewed a variety of people. We went out and shot things. He went out and shot stuff by himself. He personally, I think, facilitated the Rolling Stones getting across the border. Stuff like that. I wasn't part of it, but he went to a couple of rock concerts, and he later promoted, I think, one of them. But it was just pushing the boundaries.
Yeah. This was all pre-videotape, too. Were you shooting 16mm film?
16mm film, black and white. And then.
But pushing the boundaries, yeah, that's what it's all about.
Yeah, he was just. We rocked the boat a few times. I can remember one time there was a strike and there was some pickets. And Al felt very strongly that he was aligned with the workers on this one. And he got a Pete Seeger record. I can't remember which one it was, but it was about the workers. And in it, the word, it was goddamn or something like that. Anyhow, he got this whole thing assembled and he calls me in and he says, what do you think about this? It's pure communism. I mean, this is not marginal. This is... Workers of the world, throw off your chains, right? So I said, well, I think we better take this upstairs. So we call the suit in. He listens to it, and strokes his chin and says, well, the goddamn has to come out. Okay.
So other than that, the piece went.
Clean as a whistle.
Now, obviously, people were noticing what you were doing. People at BCTV. Who owned that place at the time?
At the originally, it was owned, the majority was owned by what was then Selkirk.
Right.
It was Selkirk, which had come out of TPC, Taylor Pearson. They owned the majority of it. Frank Griffiths wanted a piece. He wanted it, actually. He wheeled and dealed. There's a famous story, and I'm not up on the details, but I believe the company that owned the Grouse Mountain Ski Resort also had a few percentage points of it. And the story is that Frank Griffiths bought and sold Grouse Mountain in 24 hours just to strip out the piece from BCTV. Eventually, they controlled the whole thing.
But the owners there, or whoever the powers that be, obviously noticed what you were doing, took notice of what you had produced for them, and a year later, they're offering you the news director.
No, what happened was that Al and the news director, Andy Marquis, didn't really get along. After 3 months, September, October, November, 4 months, Andy Marquis accepted a position in Montreal at CFCF and became Andrew Marquis, went back on the air, and became a local hero there. I applied, along with a couple of other people from around Western Canada. They gave it to me, and so I worked with Al, but not for him, and we started the process. And most of the early stuff, Al should be given credit for, because he hired several people, Helen Slinger, Keith Bradbury, and a few more. There were some frustrations with these people and Al, and sometimes they migrated to news, and sometimes they left, and after a couple of years, Al moved on. We had quite a talent pool that he had assembled. If I was to take credit for anything, it was finding ways to unlock that. The station under Ray Peters was supportive from day one. They really were. As long as Peters was involved directly, the thing grew and prospered. Years later, he went downtown. It started to fade.
When you took over, you had a good base to work with.
Yes, I had a good base, and we had...
And then you started improving on that.
Experimenting, yes, and improving, yes. Basically, I saw it as the world's greatest storytelling instrument, and the last thing I said before I got my job in the interview was, I said, this is drama where you don't have to hire the writers or the orchestra or the actors, you know. The world will do it for you. You just got to shoot it and cut it right. Then I set about learning how to do that, and they got behind it. See, one of the things that about television that's different is that it is collaborative. Now, I've told guys in radio this. They don't want to hear the next part of it, but I've told them I learned more about radio from going into television, because when you're working announcing and there's a guy on the other side of the glass and he's waving his arms like a conductor and he's telling you more and less and up and laughing and smiling, looking sad, whatever, and he's getting the performance out of you, you'd really be surprised at how much more you can accomplish. And if program directors understood that, they would be getting much more out of the guys that they're paying to sit there and go, that was and here is. It is a performance thing. But
it relates to television too, but there are a lot more people involved, I think, is what we're
saying. Well,
it's
normal in television. Yeah. It's normal. I mean, when I started, it's improved now, but when I started, I was also on the air, once again proving that I had talents that lay elsewhere.
But you did have a great talent for building,
well,
arguably the best newscast in Canada, with a cast of stars, both reporters, anchors, behind-the-scenes people.
Yep.
You had the best cutters. You had the best audio people. You had the best of everything.
Yeah, we did.
And you had, at the beginning, very little competition. There was only the CBC at that time.
Right. And that was a real asset, because we got to make our mistakes in front of a very small audience. And I have tried to tell people now, more recently, that the worst mistake you can make is to promote something that isn't ready. And they'll get a new brand or a new sound or something, and they're going to start it at noon, and the newspaper ads are going to start running and all the rest of it. Well, unless you are saying that it's never going to improve from here, you're better off not drawing attention at that point. But that was one of the things that we did. But yes, we had a lot of really good people.
You were involved in the hiring of Tony Parsons, I believe.
Yes, I hired Tony Parsons.
And look what that turned out to be. A dynasty for the station, still unbeatable.
Yeah,
today.
Yeah, because I read McLuhan. Nobody else read McLuhan. And McLuhan said, radio is hot and television is cool. And he explained that what he was saying is that if you're in a room listening to radio, you can be focused on many other things, and radio has to really work to get from the radio speaker over to the other side of the room where you are. Television only works if you go to it. So that explained to me, I'd seen Tony operating, are working, and that explained to me why I was attracted to him, because he's tight, he's closed, you gotta go to him. He is not coming to you, he's coming to the screen, you make the rest of the thing. I said, you know, that this is perfect, this is why this guy works. We can keep him in this hermetically sealed thing where he doesn't have legs, he doesn't have anything, you know. I tried to get him to loosen his tie, but other than that, you know, we just want this guy. And as long as you shoot him tight and give him a chance and give him a script he can work with, he's magic.
Yeah.
And that's what was proved.
You know? A lot of your success was hiring the best people.
I tried to hire people who understood storytelling. And there's a lot of guys who go through so-called journalism programs who aren't reporters. They're repeaters. If you tell them what the story is, they will tell you what the story is. But if you send them out into the chaos of the world and say, come back with a story, they'll say, oh, where should I go? You know, the old joke was that you send him out to City Hall for the meeting and he comes back, says there's no story. Why? Because the hall burned down. But the fact is, now, I mean, the guys that we had, a lot of them, you could just send them out, which is what McArdle has turned into publishing career, you know. But we had, again, Bradbury, we had Helen Slinger, we had...
Webster. Oh, was Webster one of your decision?
No, I was consulted on it, but no, I was not. It was not my decision. I thought it was a great idea. I was endorsed it the moment I heard it.
Great.
It was engineered by NW, who wanted to get him off OR. Maybe that's not well known.
Part of a competitive battle that was always going on between media.
I understand there was a phone call made, I don't know which way it went, between BCTV and NW, and it was to the effect, if we take Webster off OR, you're going to have to pick up part of the tab, even though he's only appearing on television. Maybe it was an offer, we'll pick up part of the tab if you'll get him off. I don't know how it worked, but that's the story I heard.
Lots of backroom bargaining.
Yes, Yeah, that's
to,
what I mean.
To decrease the competition. Yeah. So you put in a fantastic 20 years as 20 news years. Director there,
yep.
and you built that place into the most powerful news operation in Canada. As I said before, people in Toronto might argue about that and say about CFTO, but you were at it long before and became far more successful and have the largest at 6 o'clock audience in the country.
Yeah, and I don't want to take the credit for building it myself. The guys built it. I mean, there was, when I left, there was 100 people working there. My contribution was selecting them and giving them some guidelines and giving them cars was one of the things. Had the industry's eyes open. You know, we did a lot of things that were seriously innovative. And we sent crews out to places where nobody had sent local crews. When the Terry Fox run ended in Thunder Bay, Ontario, tragically, there's a place called Allen Park in Toronto where all the microwave signals go through. Suzanne Boyce was basically our production assistant. She's now the president of CTV, creative content, whatever. She was, like so many of these people, she could get it done, whatever it was. She was given the task of seeing if we could get microwave out of... She figured out a way with the woman from BC Tel at the time, and they got a signal out, and the Toronto stations were sitting, watching the feeds coming from Allen Park, waiting for their daytime, or for their New York feeds, and they see this video going by. They'd been told there was no way they could get it, and there wasn't any way they could get it, but Suzanne figured it out, and we had it 24 hours ahead. They had royal commissions at the CBC and CTV trying to figure out how this had happened. Stunts like that. I mean, when there was a train crash in Hinton, Alberta, I think we sent 6 cameras. Boy, were the Alberta guys upset.
Yeah. Now, the 20 years was really the building, and then you saw it come to this tremendous peak of viewership, and then all of a sudden it was over.
What happened
year.
To me?
Yeah.
I got fired.
Why?
No reason was given. No reason
Do
ever.
Do you have any idea or inkling as to why it happened?
Yes. I
want to share it?
Well, I certainly can't prove it, and so I have to be careful. A person who at the time would have been reasonably close suggested to me that I had been identified as a candidate for promotion, which I didn't want, hadn't sought, and was entirely unaware of it. And that once I had been identified, I generated an enemy. And it became important for the enemy to contrive to get me fired. And because of my probably naivety and arrogance, I probably didn't behave quite appropriately as most people do in boardrooms and things. And I may have handed, if this person was an enemy, I can't prove that it was, but if the person was an enemy, they would have found it fairly easy to make the case that the newsroom would be better led by somebody a little more reliable. Or
malleable.
Yeah, yeah, I think malleable was the thing. And I don't know what the issues were. I really don't know. But one of the things that had happened was the operation really peaked in 85. And then I sold them on the idea of going to Expo, which I believe still was the right move. But it took them a long time. And they didn't have the appetite for it. And it cost them a lot of money. And they had to cut a deal to do it with lotteries and a few other things. Expo loved it. It took less than 2 minutes after I finally persuaded them that Expo would be interested. I'd done some research, and the guy who ran Expo at that point had been very proud of the fact that he'd run a World's Fair in St. Louis or someplace, and he'd had a radio station on the lot. And I said, let's go offer him a television station. He'll put us in there. There were things that didn't get done, and I was very disappointed in it. But anyhow, after that, I guess there was recession, and the budget started to diminish. Webster retired, and it was clear that they figured it had gone as far as they wanted it to go. Now, why they figured that, I don't know exactly, because there was very little communication.
Probably money.
Yeah, yeah. But somehow, when Ray Peters was running it, there was never a lot of money, but there was always
enough.
Yeah, and if you came with an idea, sometimes he'd say, I like it, come back in 3 months, you know, or come back in 6 months. So you always had a feeling there was kind of growth going on, but the bean counters got a little bit too full of themselves, and they didn't appreciate it. They did not understand it. They don't understand why it works. They don't know. They know what it works, but they don't understand why.
Well, there's talent and there's management.
I guess. Yeah.
Pretty much spells it out, I think.
Yeah. Yeah.
Most management is frightened of talent because they really don't have any themselves.
And talent can be very unpredictable. And
which makes it
very erratic. And
but makes for good things sometimes.
Oh, definitely. Definitely.
If it wasn't for the wackos in this business, we wouldn't have had the success we did.
I also, I'm still uncomfortable with the notion that I built it.
And one let's say one of the builders.
Well, let me point out that among my failures, I failed to persuade the Webster Foundation that they really ought to have a category for news cameramen, because they are the reporters.
They're the artists.
They're the, they're the ones who decide in a story what it is you're going to see. And that's what a reporter in the pencil press decides, but in television, it's the cameraman. And there are a few places that still believe that that you can tell a cameraman what to shoot. It's much better to hire a guy who knows what he needs and makes it happen. And at BCTV, we had a group of superb, seriously talented camera people. They've never been given any kind of acknowledgement. They're all characters. They have amazing stories, wonderful, wonderful stories of the things that idiots on the desk like me had asked them to do. They truly are totally unsung. And all the preeners, you know, stand around and congratulate one another, but it's the cameramen who, and the editors sometimes, who make it happen. And when the news hour was really flying, there were, sometimes there would be 25, 35 minutes where there wasn't a bad cut. It was just, if you had any interest in the world at all, there was a picture coming up that, and as soon as you, just when you thought you had enough from that picture, there would be a new picture and a new picture. That was, the central craft was, or the central project was marrying journalism to what the camera and the video really can do. And they're losing that, and not just them.
It's becoming a lost
part. Yes.
Because they don't want, again, to put out the money for that. Their television stations now are begging viewers to send them video.
I don't think they understand. You know, I do think that there is enough money. I mean, you can hire somebody to sit and do nothing, or you can hire somebody and, you know, McArdle, for example, still, to this day, takes pride in the fact that he does not take direction from anyone. And when he starts out in the morning, he has no idea where he's going.
Where he's going or what he's going to do.
The cameraman that, I don't know who he's working with now, but the guys he used to work with would, they would sometimes shepherd him in a general area, but he'd always find a spin on it. Because he understands the elements of the story, he understands what's necessary to make the story work, and does. And the cameramen understand that. And the editors, I don't know them now, but the ones I work with, really understood that. I'll tell you a story about that. By the time we were getting going, Simon Fraser started a film school. And this is for people who are into serious cinematography and cinematic art. And a couple of these guys showed up on our door. Two of them, I remember, both were serious freaks. Serious freaks. They had hair down to here. And one of them was from Berkeley, if not two. It came at different times. They were going to the film school. And I said, all we want is you guys to make these cuts as fast as you can. And in those days, we were still using hot splicing. One of our guys, Gary Payne, came in and he said, people are using this tape. They're using this 3M.
Scotch tape tab.
Scotch tape thing, yeah. They're using this for film editing. We're going to try it. Okay, let's try it. So I said to these guys from Simon Fraser, you know, we just want these splices to hold. And then you can go through them again and turn them into whatever art you want, you know. But we got a 400-foot reel here. We got to do 6 minutes, and we got to do it now. One of them came in and he said, well, you know, the guy who runs the film school at Simon Fraser says that this is just like for the Philistines. I mean, this is just, you're never going to be an artiste if you waste your time these cretins and Philistines in the newsroom. And I said, how much film do you shoot and edit up there in a month? Oh, maybe 800 feet. Two mags, right? I said, well, here, you're going to go through 800 feet a day. And if you want to stay at night and recut it, that's fine. The guys who hung in, and there was two or three of them, have done very well. Some of whom have names that you would recognize. Two or three of the names. The woman who did My American Cousin, she came out of our newsroom. Forgotten the fella's name who directed two or three major movies. They never refer to BCTV on their resume.
That's considered hack work. Yeah,
I think so.
Among the film cognoscenti. Fast forward to 2010. In between the end of BCTV and now, you've been doing consulting work, both for radio and television, a little bit on the side.
A little bit. Not and, very much.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to hear all this stuff.
Not anymore. No, they think they know everything.
Well, they think the business is changing.
That's the other thing I wanted to talk to you about. If Cameron Bell was running either Global or any other major television newsroom today, what would he be doing that isn't being done?
Well, I would examine the story selection. I would examine those. I would deploy reporters far differently than they're being deployed. I would remind them who they're working for. I was mightily offended a couple of years ago by a reporter who I won't name, who taunted a fellow who was, I believe he was a fugitive, and he was dropped, and they were, you know, those guys lying on the ground with his in handcuffs or something. This reporter went up and said something about, how does it feel now? Like, we gotcha. And what it revealed was that he certainly had no neutrality in the situation. I see a great deal of people shifting to the establishment point of view, whatever it is. I don't feel like I could phone many organizations that are on the air right now and tell them that I was a victim of serious injustice, and I don't think they'd care. I think they would tell me that's the way it goes, you know? I think they don't care. Yeah, it's not that they politically motivated or anything. I just think they don't care. They don't see the audience. I don't see that the way to get the audience's attention is to appeal to the audience's sense of fair play and justice. So I would really work in that area, and I would try to develop much better relations with the audience, because you can. I made a list not long ago. I was thinking of making a pitch, and there's about 20 things on the list that I thought could be done and should be done, because they would increase the profits with the existing resources. And they're going down the wrong path in many cases. Poor old CNN doesn't know which way is up. The networks are having serious problems. And you look at the networks, and their production values are wonderful. You know, they're really fine. They're still spending the money on production, but they are not touching the viewer. They're not, except when they're getting really maudlin.
Is there a future for television as we know it in this multi-channel universe? The internet, of course, where everything is now available. Is it going to survive?
The only thing that's available is that which has been produced by somebody, whether it's by an existing organization or by the fellow who videotaped the Dukansky homicide. I think there's a serious need for exploration of moving pictures and sound as a way to tell stories, because it is so volatile. If you are dealing in print, you can really limit the reaction, the range of emotions, for example. But as soon as you turn on a television camera and you're getting a 21-inch picture, you're getting a vast amount of information. And controlling that and making sure that it isn't getting in the way of the story or is enhancing the story without being phony and without being manufactured is very delicate, and that takes serious craft. And I don't see a lot of effort going into that. I heard a story very recently about a local reporter who wrote a letter of complaint to a management, the gist of which was that the PR person had not handed out appropriately.
I like to finish these things off by asking, what was Cameron Bell's favorite moment in his career, either in radio or television?
The highlight, I remember when we had a good television program that the next morning I was still high on. I used to get up and, yeah, we did it, you know. And that would happen once every 10 days or so, would you get a combination of stories and production and presentation and the whole thing just sang. I never got a perfect program. That moment I told you about earlier with Warren Barker acknowledging my arrival in the market was pretty big. The Webster Award was very gratifying.
Yes, you've had a few awards too. We never mentioned those. But. You're like most guys. You're way too modest. Hide your light under a bushel.
Well, I mean, the Webster one was, I was very proud of that. I'm definitely proud of some of the stories we did. I'm proud of some of the stands we took, some of the ground we broke. But I'm saddened to see that there is a huge shift to the banal. It's sliding backwards. I'm encouraged by CBC. I think hiring Tony helped. I think it signaled their desire to build. Unfortunately, their scheduling is an ongoing problem, but I think that's good. I don't know about, there weren't really moments.
A series of them.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you play for. I remember one time, you mentioned a couple of times your arguments from the guys in Toronto. They were all out here on RTNDA session. We had the news directors from across the country, including the guys from CTV. I contrived to take them on a tour of the station that avoided the newsroom, where we'd done quite a few innovations, until I brought them down through the scene dock and through the back end to this doorway at exactly 1 minute, right at 12 o'clock, basically, when the new news was starting. And I told them we were going into the live studio and opened the doors, big double doors, and the studio is fully lighted, the sets right in their face. Loved the moment of watching them, because they were just turning green with
envy.
Jaw-dropping. Yeah. And I made sure that Ray Peters and the rest of the suits knew about the triumph it was for them, because it was a reminder to a lot of people in Toronto that the only people that think it's the center of the universe live there.
Cameron Bell, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, and on behalf of the people who are interested in all this, thank you for taking the time to do it.